Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not so much that half a loaf is better than none. It's more like 26% of a loaf is better than none. The Greek debt deal is done for real, this time we're told, but at quite a discount for investors. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 21st of February. It is good, as always, to have you with us. We've been here before, I know, thinking the Greek debt crisis is well and truly over. But it does seem that this time, Athens and its lenders really mean it. Pretty much everybody that Greece owes money to, other countries, the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, are going to take a loss on what they're owed. Haircut is the vernacular. Private bondholders, by mutual agreement, will get back just 26 cents for every dollar they're owed. Hans Humes is one of those private creditors. He's the president of Greylock Capital Management. It's a hedge fund. Mr. Humes, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So what do you think? A 74% haircut. Fair, not fair?
You know, I've been doing sovereign restructurings for 20-something years, and one of the things you learn is if you go in there with a thought of what's fair and what's not fair, it's going to be tough to get things done. This is a situation where there is far too much debt for the Greek economy to support. I think within the context, we ended up getting a deal that is workable.
There was a great quote in one of the many articles about this story today. Some investor in Greek bonds saying, this deal is the farthest thing from voluntary you can imagine. Did you have a choice? Did you have to go along with this, or could you have said, no, I'm not doing it?
I think we had a choice. So, I mean, it's difficult to say voluntary, involuntary. I don't think anybody wants to walk away from as much debt as we have, but, you know, the alternative is just a total default by Greece.
Yeah.
And I think that that might actually end up being worse for everybody.
Is a total default by Greece, a chaotic default by that country, is that off the table now, or at least for the next 3 years, the terms of this agreement?
I think it's off the table. I think the chaotic nature of it was underestimated by some of the people who were involved in the negotiations on behalf of a few of the European countries. On the private sector side, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but I think what we could have looked forward to would have been a couple years of not getting anything if Greece had defaulted.
So you are what's known in the trade as a high-yield guy. You go looking for these risky investments, right? I mean, that's your thing.
Yeah, I think that we do high-yield and distress globally. But we're high-yield investors.
Which means what? I mean, lay that out for me in terms of how you go looking at these countries. I'm trying to get to the point of why Greece was interesting to you in the first place.
Oh, that's pretty tricky. really, really complicated from the outside, and frankly, on the inside, it was really complicated. But it was terrain we understood. We've been there before. What's going on in Europe is not unfamiliar to anybody who's been involved in what's now considered to be the emerging markets. And what's telling is the financial and legal advisors to Greece are also the financial and legal advisors to Ivory Coast, to Ecuador, to Argentina.
It sounds a little bit like there's this gang of usual suspects who go around the world having to deal with this stuff.
You know, when you get a country that has too much debt and it can't afford to pay it, you have to go back to the precedents. And, you know, it is the usual gang of suspects who understand the, you know, what the playing field is.
Is it possible that Greek debt is now a buying opportunity?
If you look at where it's trading now and the possible value, yeah, I think it does look potentially interesting. You referred to...
interesting. I love that word. That's great.
Well, I mean, listen, there are no guarantees in this world, but the deal risk on this is pretty low. I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen pretty quickly. So, you know, there's the possibility to buy bonds and make money, but this is not a retail trade.
Yeah.
I don't think this is something that... If you've got a retail account, you go looking to buy some long-dated Greek bonds.
Yeah. Hans Humes, he's the president of Greylock Capital Management. He owns some Greek debt. Mr. Humes, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
No problem. Thank you.
Don't know if you heard, but the Dow hit 13,000 today. You know what that means economy-wise? Nothing. Not a thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of things you can buy at a discount, like just, for instance, Greek government debt, discount retail in this country has been attracting a lot of customers, par for the course in an economy that's been through what ours has. The biggest discounter of them all, Walmart, announced fourth quarter profits today. Sales were brisk, thanks to those aforementioned discounts, but profits suffered, thanks to those aforementioned discounts. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, reports Walmart is stuck in a big box version of Catch-22.
Walmart is struggling with some of the most profound questions to face retailers, especially in tight times. Questions like this one.
How many different types of mustard does a store really need to carry?
At Trutina Financial, retail analyst Patty Edwards says Walmart had cut way back on selection in favor of its most profitable items. But the retailer has returned lately to what it calls heritage merchandise, ranging from fabric to fishing tackle. It's vowed in its online ads to put some 8,500 more items on its store shelves.
We've brought a lot of these items back. We just want to make sure that we have low prices every day on everything.
They went a little bit too far, and now they've brought some of those brands back that people had been coming to them for.
Walmart finds itself looking for that sweet spot with customers, not just with choice, but also the low price promise that it strayed from briefly as it chased higher profits. Instead, sales suffered and only recently have started to turn around. Bill Simon, the head of Walmart's U.S. operations, said in his profit presentation today the retailer is on the right track.
I'm pleased with our strategic plan and how customers are responding to increased assortment and lower prices. We're investing in price and winning back customer traffic.
At the University of Cincinnati, business school dean David Szymanski says Walmart has succeeded in the past with its everyday low price strategy.
Margins take a hit, but if you can make it up in terms of total sales, at the end of the day, you're going to be a profitable company.
But some analysts say the growth in the corner dollar store these days is giving Walmart a run for its money. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Sony is going to release its latest gizmo. Tomorrow, the PlayStation Vita goes on sale in the U.S. and Europe. It's the successor to the PSP, the PlayStation Portable. That is, it's a handheld game console. This one has a 5-inch touchscreen, motion sensors, and two cameras. But when everybody and their grandma already has tablets and smartphones with big touchscreens and motion sensors and cameras, who really needs a PlayStation Vita? Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
These days, you can play video games pretty much anywhere. Jesse Divnick is an analyst with EDAR.
In the elevator, in the office, or at home.
Or even in a radio studio.
So it really comes down to the experience you're looking for.
Divnick says games designed for tablets and smartphones are fun and addictive, but they're way different from the kind of games made for Xbox 360 and Wii. They're much more sophisticated. What's Angry Birds by comparison?
A bite-sized snack of entertainment.
Sony is going after gamers who want more than just a snack. They want vivid single-player games, a 12-course dinner to go. These are young men with disposable incomes living in and around big cities. Carl Howe does consumer research for the Yankee Group.
They've got to tap into the diehard gamers and convince them that this is going to give them something better than they're going to get on their phone, and that's a tall order.
Especially when the low-end model costs $250. Howe says he's skeptical the PlayStation Vita will be as successful as the PSP. Sony sold more than 60 million of those worldwide. But the Vita looks pretty sleek. It has two joysticks, a touchpad on the back.
High-resolution graphics, accelerated 3D, 30 frames per second. This is not some sort of second-order video game experience.
Sony's trying to make that case with a $50 million marketing campaign, hoping that if it's successful, gamers will open their wallets and find room in their already packed pockets for one more device. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In Washington, D.C. today, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission admitted, in kind of a roundabout way, how much it didn't know in the early hours of the Fukushima meltdown after the earthquake in Japan last year. The NRC released recordings and transcripts from its Emergency Operations Center at the request of the public radio program Burn, an energy journal. Its host, Alex Chadwick, is here with us. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
Let's set the stage. March 11th last year, a magnitude 9 earthquake 40 miles off the coast of northeast Japan. And then the water starts, the tsunami.
Boy, the tsunami, right. So this is the worst earthquake to hit Japan since record-keeping began. The tsunami, just enormous. I've seen more recent reports. I think it was maybe 70 feet high.
Ooh.
So it hits the area of the Fukushima nuclear complex. And for 4 of the 6 reactors, it knocks out the diesel generators. These are critical to keep the thing cool.
Right.
So 3 reactors were operating at the time. They did shut down, but after they shut down, they're still hot. You've got to keep this water circulating or else really bad things happen. That's what's going on. So this is like, you know, afternoon in Japan. It's midnight in Washington. In a couple of hours, people at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission start getting emergency calls. They come to work. And
a couple hours. It took a couple hours for the NRC to get these calls.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Because, you know, first the tsunami hits and then they figure out, oh, man, things are – okay.
Right.
So – workday starts, and they activate this thing called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Emergency Operations Center.
Okay.
The last time this thing was activated was 9/11, so it's a big deal.
Big deal, yeah.
Right. So when they activate this, they record what happens. Lucky for us. Listen, here it is.
And there's some somewhat alarming language that talks about, and I'll just quote, the IAEA tells us the earthquake triggered a power failure at the Fukushima Daiichi Unit 2 nuclear power plant.
Okay, yeah. So the IAEA, this is International Atomic Energy Agency, everyone trying to follow this. That person speaking is the NRC Deputy Executive Director. His name's Mike Weber. And this recording is from about an hour after the emergency center is activated. We'll go back to it.
Okay.
And then when that backup generator also failed, the cooling system was unable to supply water to cool the reactor. Specialists at the IAEA understand the fuel core is still covered by water, but they question if it will remain so.
Wow. Scary when nuclear guys start using phrases like alarming language, right?
Okay. So this is just the first day of recordings.
Yeah. How long does this go on?
This goes on for about 10 days while they run this situation. And what you get from reading this and listening to it is that they really don't know what is going on. They're getting little dribs and drabs of information. Here's a senior executive at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. His name is Bill Rulin, and he's talking about what's called INES. That's the International Nuclear Event Scale. It's a measure of accident severity.
We checked the INES scale, and they're at least at a level 3, which is a serious incident. And the only reason we don't think there are any more is because we have sparse information,
he says.
That's not
so
good.
I'm telling you, they had no information. They are watching. This is the NRC. They're watching YouTube and CNN, and they're checking.
No, they're not.
Yes, and checking wiki postings because this area is so devastated by the earthquake and the tsunami. So many people are lost, 20,000. The infrastructure's all blown away. And here we have this real ultra-high-tech crisis going on in the information age. They have no information.
Alex Chadwick is the host of a new public radio series. It's called Burn, from Sound Vision Productions and distributed by American Public Media. Alex is going to be back as the Fukushima anniversary approaches on the 11th of March with more of these stories. Special thanks also today to the National Science Foundation. Alex, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
If you want to read some of those transcripts, all 3,000 pages of them for yourselves, there's a link to them on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
I love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. My mom has always been like, oh, like, he went to your school.
Yeah, Ferris is no role model, but the movie, that can teach you things. But first, let's do the numbers. So as I said, the Dow Industrials hit 13,000 today for the first time since 2008. In the end, the Dow finished up 15 points, a 10%. 12,965 was the close. The Nasdaq deleted 3 points, a 10%, ended things at 29.48. The S&P 500 ticked up nearly a point. We'll call that flat 13.62. In case you're wondering, the high watermark for the Dow, 14.164 at the close. That happened in October 2007, which seems somehow very, very long ago. Today's batch of quarterly earnings reports was rather hospitable, you might say. Wynn Resorts raked in 6%. Choice Hotels International upgraded by 3.5%. Kraft Foods took up 1.5%. Today, Macy's displayed an increase of 1.2%. Home Depot built on a 0.5% gain. Walmart sold off almost 4%. Then after missing analyst estimates, as we told you about, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for January. President Obama participates in a groundbreaking ceremony for the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. And it's the first day of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not to pry, but what'd you have for breakfast? Toast? Yogurt? Fresh fruit? Maybe? By the end of the day, it's hard to remember and sometimes hard to worry too much about that. But for a lot of people in this economy, what we eat is way more than a quick bite. It's a livelihood and a way of life. Tracy McMillan writes about that in her new book. It's called The American Way of Eating. Tracy, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wonder if we could break down the title a little bit, because this isn't so much the American way of eating as it is the American way of growing and buying and selling and then getting our food to our plates, right?
Right. It ended up being more ambitious than I had realized, right? So I decided what I would do is I would go and work in three parts of the food system. So I worked as a farm worker in fields in California. And then I moved on to work in the produce section of Walmart, a Walmart supermarket outside of Detroit. And then I finished up in the kitchen at a New York City Applebee's. And, you know, part of the wrinkle in this was that I had to live and eat off my wages the whole time.
Right, right. Just make it a little more challenging, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. As much as this is a book about food, it's a book about people too, right? It's about the characters you met in the fields in the Central Valley of California and at the Walmarts and at the Applebee's. And the one that sticks with me after having read this book was your first forewoman, right? Pilar in the fields of Southern Great Valley here in California.
There was a farm worker family that was going back to Mexico for a few weeks to visit family. And so the idea was I could stay in their trailer. And what I was told was, well, you can just sort of walk around the trailer park and ask people for work. So I, you know, went to the first trailer and I said, hola, you know, and hi. I'm like, my name's Tracy. I'm looking for work. And, you know, they sort of looked at me like I was crazy. It was like a mom, a dad, and a kid. But after talking with them a little bit, you know, the woman said, well, I'm a forewoman. If you want to come work with me, you can come work with me. And so I said, that would be great. And she really ended up being just a wonderful friend and a really generous woman.
Well, that whole experience to me was made all the more meaningful by the fact that when you were working in the fields with her and the other folks on that small team that you were with, your inability to do the job, and I'm not mischaracterizing because you say it yourself, I guess you were cutting grapes that first day and you had no idea what you were doing. Your inability to do your job meant money out of their pockets.
Right. So we talk a lot about piece rate, and you think, oh, I will make, you know, this amount of money for this amount of product as an individual. But a lot of crops are actually pooled in terms of piece rate. So a whole crew of people will get paid by piece rate, you know, for the amount of grapes that they harvest. And so because we were paid by crew, that the three of us, you know, sort of pooled what we made that day together, and that meant that I basically robbed them of wages to some extent. And that's also because we were being paid piece rate, mm-hmm. and it wasn't being brought up to minimum wage.
Did the people that you met on your stations of the cross, if you will, of the American food system, in the fields and at Walmart working produce and at Applebee's, did they understand that they're cogs in this enormous agricultural machine that we have?
Mostly, you know, people are just working to get by. And when you're at the really low levels of the wage system, people are just thinking, how do I get more money? So it doesn't matter how many hours you are out there. What matters is that you're amassing more money.
So at the end of the day, other than farm work is hard and people in the food chain don't get paid a lot and Americans generally don't eat healthy stuff, what'd you learn?
I just saw over and over again how much people in all levels of American society care about their food, and that really what's holding folks back, I think, from making better food choices isn't so much that they don't know to eat their vegetables or they don't care about their health, but that there are all these other pressures that make it really hard for them to do so.
Tracy McMillan. Her book is called The American Way of Eating. Tracy, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Did you see the Matthew Broderick commercial during the Super Bowl, the one where he riffs off Ferris Bueller? Anyone? Anyone? Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the movie? A couple of months ago, we went looking for a way to tell the story of how people are feeling about their lives, what they hoped for when they were younger, what they expected would happen. So we went to the movies, places made famous in screenplays. And the first stop in a series that's coming over the next couple of days was Ferris Bueller's hometown. Here's Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off is a movie about, above all else, joy. The sheer joy of doing whatever you want, getting away with anything you want for one perfect day. It's the story of a clever high school senior who spends a day with his friends in downtown Chicago after convincing his parents that he's sick.
You fake a stomach cramp, and when you're bent over, moaning and wailing, you lick your palms. It's a little childish and stupid, but then so is high school.
Oh yeah, one more thing you need to know. Ferris is supremely, awesomely confident. The kind of kid you only wish you could have been.
I love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. My mom has always been like, oh, like, he went to your school, the director.
That's high school senior Jody Snyder, whose mom was right. Jody goes to Glenbrook North High School, where parts of the movie were shot. It's also where director John Hughes went to high school. It's the kind of high school where almost everyone goes to college. It's in Northbrook, Illinois, a Chicago suburb sprinkled with white colonials where the median value of homes is around $500,000. It's full of professionals. It's a kind of place that people stick around. They grow up here, raise their own kids here. And I'm here, back in high school, to find out how life has changed since Ferris, had he actually existed, graduated 25 years ago. Change one. Kids today are more anxious about the world outside of high school than Ferris or his friends ever were.
20 years ago when they say, I don't know what I'm going to do, it was, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I really don't care yet. I'll figure it out. And now it's like, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I'm really nervous about that.
Mike Piskel has been teaching at Glenbrook North for 31 years. He says there was some truth to Ferris's happy-go-lucky world as my oyster confidence. Today, kids are more stressed. Way more stressed. They still want to be successful and rich and happy grown-ups, but...
Now it's like, gee, you know, we've got everything from global warming to an economic downturn, so what's going to happen to me?
Some of the Ferris confidence is gone, perhaps because of change, too. Kids are well aware of the economic downturn. Ferris was decidedly upper middle class. His friend Cameron, upper, upper class. Cameron's dad had a 1961 Ferrari 250 GT California.
I love driving it. It is so choice. If you have the means...
Folks in Northbrook today still make good money. The median household income is above 100 grand a year. But...
There's an underneath kind of palpable feeling that a lot of people aren't sharing the real pain of what is occurring financially within their homes.
That's the school's principal, Paul Prima. There are foreclosures in Northbrook. Property values are down a third. Parents are losing jobs, changing jobs.
Our counselors are dealing with kids that are feeling all kinds of pressures, and this time of year with college placement, the realities of what happens if I do get accepted to a private school on the East Coast, will my family even be able to provide the financial backing for that decision?
There's an anxiety about money that we don't see in Ferris. There's worry about the future, which brings us to change three. Kids just don't skip school the way they used to.
This is my ninth sick day this semester. It's getting pretty tough coming up with new illnesses.
Today, not so much. In fact, not at all. Here's Principal Prima again.
The kids just said, we come to school and we're sick. We can't afford to miss those minutes of class.
Kids care about high school and getting good grades and getting into a good college.
You miss a lot of work that you need to do later on. It's not worth it, really.
That's high school senior Jody again. Sure, she says, there are times in classes she wishes she was somewhere else. Times she's excited for college. But there's another reason she wouldn't skip.
I think high school is really fun. And there's something so safe and nice about going back to your house every day. Just everyone is there and you go to high school and just, you know, you're taken care of.
A change. It's a different portrait altogether of the high school that John Hughes and Ferris gave us. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is either the secret to good human resources management at companies everywhere or yet another indicator that Facebook is nothing more than an enormous time suck. There's a study out in the Journal of Applied Social Psychology this month. It looks at whether people's profiles on social networks, by which the study means Facebook, can predict job performance. The short answer is, yeah, you bet they can. The slightly longer answer leads to this at the bottom of the study. One, they say they need to do more research to fully validate their findings. And two, I'm quoting here, consideration of legal risks should be fully considered. You betcha. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM on a Tuesday. Today, the Dow up 15 points, a tenth of 1%. Got to and then left 13,000 behind. The NASDAQ took off 3 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 ticked up nearly a point. We'll call it flat. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. They are in Michigan this week, by the way, ahead of the primary there. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here in Los Angeles tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.